Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 624, July 2022.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I am your host, Jason Snell, and I am joined this time once again by The Incomparable's most prolific panelist and also one of our most prolific novelists. It's Dan Morin. Dan, welcome back once again to the podcast.
So good to be here. They'll put that on my tombstone, Jason. You put a lot of words together. They weren't all great, but there were a lot of them.
So many words. Actually, you're maybe on your grave they'll put joining me now is Dan Morin.
Thanks God.
Okay, very presumptive there. We're here to talk about the Nova Incident, a novel coming out July 26th that is your latest installment in the Galactic Cold War series. It's book 3. And by that, I mean, it's the fourth novel in the series, but it's book 3. Because you start from zero, like a good programmer would.
Yeah,
you start
sure, that's what it is. That's a more charitable answer than my, I had an off by one error somewhere in my counting. Yep. Yeah. My most frequently asked question, it still plagues me to this day that people try to figure out the numbering. I put a thing, there is an FAQ on my website now that explains it.
That's good.
People still ask.
Basically, you know, when it comes from another publisher, it doesn't count.
Yep. That's how it works.
So Nova Incident, the latest in the Galactic Cold War series. We're going to talk about it because this is the thing that you and I get to do is we get to chat about your book and writing and all of that. And people should go, obviously, buy the Nova Incident or pre-order it or whenever you're listening to this. It'll be out shortly or it's already out. And it is the latest in a fun series of spies in space, or in this spies case, on a planet, which, as we've established on The Incomparable, planets are in space.
Indeed. Nailed it.
So this is a same characters that you know from the previous books, and they get into an adventure that I would say, if I were to summarize it, I would say that it is incited by an act of domestic terrorism at the, or terrorism, unclear whether it's domestic or not, but an act of terrorism at the heart of the Commonwealth, which is the government, the planet-spanning government that your characters work for. Mm-hmm. And it leads to all sorts of ramifications as the investigation spins out. And by the way, the book cover is very nice. I had the pleasure of reading this book when it was in draft form, and I had the pleasure of participating along with Anthony Johnston in a conversation with you about the book cover and all the different options that you had, and I think it worked out pretty well. There's a cityscape with some flames and a space station, and you're saying, is the space station there for show? And the answer is, friends, no, it's not. There is a space station in the Nova Incident.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's relevant.
It's good, and the blue color, and it's the Nova Incident as a name. So one of our questions, we have lots of questions that we're going to get to. Thank you to everybody who sent in questions for Dan. But one of the questions was about the title of your books.
Okay.
And specifically, the question was, let me see if I can find it here. But it was, what were the original names for your books? Yes, this was from Andrew.
Okay.
What were the original working names for each of your novels?
Yes, we've covered some of these before.
Right.
Because when we talked about the Caledonian Gambit, which had several titles.
Resurrection Man
Gambit,
for the
Resurrection
longest time.
Resurrection Man was the longest running title. And then briefly, Sons of Caledonia, which I think is the name of the episode we did about it.
Yep. Yeah, because I suggested that title and I liked it so much I named the episode about it.
Yep. No, it's a good title. It was, I think, deemed when I may have made the pitch list, but I think it was deemed to sound a little too fantasy. As opposed to science fiction. So I think, and then of course the Caledonian Gambit, which is a thing.
Yeah, because Gambit's less fantastical.
Yeah, very super, super hard sci-fi there. No, and that one came up from brainstorming stuff, and I think I jokingly was like, this is like my Robert Ludlum title. Uh-huh. And unfortunately, I got kind of stuck in that vein now. I got Ludlum'd. I think our pal Anthony Johnston also has a similar experience with that. I mean, it works for thrillers. Like, and I mean, this is sort of like a spy thriller, right? Yeah. Like, so it has that angle to it. Bayern Agenda was originally titled Break the Bank.
Right.
Which was a reference to that actually was a reference to the song which Lawrence of Arabia played by Peter O'Toole sings about breaking the bank in Monte Carlo, just because I love that sentiment. The Olive Extraction was originally the Quella Affair, Quelle. Mm-hmm. I was told that was difficult to pronounce, and uh-huh. I should come up with a better title. And so that's where the Olive Extraction came from.
But originally, slightly easier to pronounce, but not really that easy.
Not everybody gets it right. I finally have a title that has only one way to be pronounced.
Yeah, Nova Incident.
Yeah. And the original title for this one. Oh, okay. So I have a working title. It's a spoiler, and that's why it was always only a working title, and we'll get to that in a second. The title it almost went to print with was The Nomad Protocol.
Oh, yeah, right. That's the one
and
I saw.
I was told, basically, my agent advised me that did not play a significant enough part in the events of the book to warrant being the title. And yeah, I thought,
I agree.
That's a fair point. So I brainstormed a bunch of stuff. I think I ran a bunch of stuff past probably you and some other people who had read the book early. Mm-hmm. And the Nova Incident, I think, was the winner on that one.
Yep.
Should there be future books? There may be titles already in mind, but we'll see. It's easier once you have a format, right? The blank blank.
Yeah.
The adjective noun. You know.
Sure. The orange argument.
Yes. There you go. Done.
Yeah. Perfect. All right. Well. We're just kicking it off here. Anything hit you? This is a book. Is this the first book you wrote where you were under contract when you wrote it, as opposed to being speculative?
No.
Or was the previous book that?
The previous. So Aleph was part of a 2-book deal. So basically when we sold the Bayern Agenda, my agent was like, hey, you know, we should do a 2-book deal because you never know with series, right? Like, you might not know until the subsequent book whether the first book even did well. So you should kind of have that one in the chamber, as it were.
Right.
And so they contracted for me 2 books. This book had to be renegotiated. It was, I'm not going to say the easiest sell. I think I was not finished when we sold it, but I was well underway in writing it by that point. And it, you know, for business reasons, which we may also discuss at other points, it was... You know, it's tricky. Series are tricky because you never sell as many books as you do the first book in a series. It's just the way it works. It's very rare otherwise, right?
Sure.
Because people buy the first book and some people tail off or decide the series isn't for them. Very few people buy the second or third book in a series and think, I'll start here. And then if they do, they probably go back and buy the earlier ones.
Friends, this might be why the book one in the series is called book one, even though there was a book zero.
Ding, ding.
Maybe.
Yeah. So it wasn't written under contract, but it was written with an eye to, I think we can probably sell this and... I would like to write this story. I will also say some of that was dictated by the fact that when this book was written, which was 2020, a year where many things happened, and I decided I just wanted to write this, you know, the continuing adventures of these characters mm-hmm. as a sort of solace to myself, if nothing else.
Okay. And then you went back to your publisher and said,
how'd you like another one?
Here's another one. And they said yes. And so
they said they with some. Yeah, it was a little bit of a negotiation.
Yeah.
I will say I didn't. My payday on this one, a little lower than previous ones. But I am hopeful that that will pan out for me in the end, because a lower advance means potentially faster to earn royalties depending on how well it sells. So hopefully it sells well. Everybody listening, that's your cue.
Yeah, that's right. Do that. Has it hit you? Has it hit you at any point, or will it hit you maybe when this comes out that you are the author of a 4-book science fiction novel series? What an idea, right? It's not just like I had a novel published, right? Which you've had for a while now, but it's like literally you have you're now one of those people who's written a 4-book science fiction novel series.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, it's not something I sit and think about that much, but I definitely every once in a while it does occur to me, and I am inordinately proud of what I've done. I am very happy with the series thus far. I've been really lucky in like this book and the last book both got starred reviews from Publisher Weekly, which was really flattering. And I've had people say some very nice things about it, which is great. And I think what I struggle with a little bit in that regard is definitely thinking like, well, I've told these stories and these are great. On the one hand, I have an idea for like, well, you know, I've written a series, right? Every person who writes a series sets out with the idea of like, I'm going to conclude my series eventually.
Right.
Some of them go on a lot longer than others. Some of them go on very short. And, you know, a lot of people, I think, expect series to fall in that trilogy, you know, structure.
Right.
Which this does not. I will just be frank about that. Not least of all because there's been 4 books so far. So unless I'm going the Douglas Adams route,
right,
it's not a trilogy. And then I think the other part of it is like as proud as I am of having written this series, I also feel like I want to be able to do other things too. And it's not that I don't want to continue work on this series. It's just that like I have now proved to myself I can do that and I can tell this story and these types of books. And that's great. And I want to keep doing that. But I also want to be able to stretch myself and tell other types of things. So now it's the risk of like I don't want to get pigeonholed into like you wrote this series and this is the one thing that you'll ever do or one story series that you'll ever write. It's like, no, I can do other things than this too. But I love this because it has been so important to me and I love the stories and the characters.
Now this story, I'd say this book ends more ambiguously than some of your other books have. Would it be safe to say that you have had an overarching sort of like running in the background story arc that is coming to the forefront in this book?
Yes, that would be fair to say. I set out to write this series always with a longer arc in mind because my favorite books are the ones where it's like, okay, it's kind of a self-contained adventure, but like overall, you're still telling something that's a bit larger because that's something you can do in books and to a degree in things like movie or TV shows and comics. I guess now in movies, if you consider Marvel.
Yeah.
That I liked, that it's kind of a fun element of storytelling I like where there's a micro story and a macro story. And so I always kind of knew where this macro story would be going. I set out with, I think I've said this before, but I'll say it again, set out with 7 books in mind in sort of more recent times. I have sort of condensed that down to 6 just because of like looking ahead and thinking about what stories I want to tell and what the next subsequent books would be. And I really hope I get to write those at some point. Their future right now, a little bit uncertain, a little bit depending on how well this book sells.
Right. So again, the Nova Incident, again, available July 26th.
Please buy this book and please tell your friends to buy this book or buy this book for your friends. If you're a real friend, you buy books for your friends. But yeah, I wanted to tell a big overarching story because it's a big stage, right? The series is called the Galactic Cold War for a reason. There is a Galactic Cold War going on. And I feel like at a certain point that may come to a head, right? As our Cold War did in the United States and Soviet Union. I like the idea, something needs to change, right? Like I didn't want to spin this out being a story of like, oh, okay, it's 30 books and it goes on forever. No, I wanted there to be stuff that changed and things that evolved and developments that, you know, sort of threw wrenches into various plans and whatever. So, you know, yeah, I think it's kind of you to say this book ends ambiguously. I think it definitely ends on a bit of a cliffhanger, I guess you could say.
I think I would put it, because I know sometimes people feel ripped off when there's a cliffhanger at the end of a novel. I would say your story ends and then there's a coda, basically, where the story arc enters and says,
right,
bum bum bum, right? And
right.
And so
yeah,
so
exactly.
You have your story has this, the Nova Incident has a clear ending,
yes,
but then it also has a twist that happens after really the proper ending. I mean, it's literally like everybody gets back from having resolved the plot, and then
right,
something
pats themselves on the back, and everything's great.
Yeah, and then something happens that makes you go, "What?" And that's like where you're left. So I would say that's a good construction in terms of it being feeling like you didn't buy part of something, but that you got something that was satisfying and also part of a larger whole. That makes sense.
Yeah, that's what I'm shooting for. I think you can do both of those things, and that is what I enjoy doing with this.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Series.
All right. Do you want to take some questions? Because we got a lot of questions.
Let's do some questions.
All right. I'm going to start with some questions about the writing process, because sometimes people are fascinated by the sheer, just the detailed process of writing. So I tried to put a bunch of these together that were sort of similar. Bob wants to know, do you think about how your audience will interpret your work, and how do you adapt your work based on your expectation of their interpretation? The idea of like you're trying to think of I've said before, novels are kind of machines constructed to elicit certain responses in the reader. That's sort of you, and you don't necessarily always think of it that way when you're writing it, but that is one of the things that makes a novel work, is thinking about like, what am I trying to do and what a response am I trying to elicit from the audience? So how do you consider that when you're writing?
I don't always think very much about theme. Sometimes you set out to write something and you're like, oh, I've got this big question in mind, and I kind of want to write a story that sort of illuminates that. But I do often think about things like tone and atmosphere in terms of a story that I want to tell, and the what I want my readers to take away from that. For example, in the Nova Incident, I wanted to write something that was a little more claustrophobic and a little more based in sort of, paranoia or something, but like having that element of the spy thriller is like, oh, I kind of know in my head the kind of stories that I would consume, whether they're books or movies, that put me in that headspace. And how do I convey that to a reader? And so in terms of like readers interpreting things, I think things like, plot, word choice, all this stuff goes into constructing an atmosphere in the same way that you might build a set for a show, for a theatrical production or a TV or movie production. And you're like, well, we want it to feel like this, and for people to take away this, this sense of what that world is like. And so I think that's where I spend a lot of my time, is trying to build an atmosphere around the story I'm telling in order to convey, like, put someone else who's reading this into the same headspace of feeling like, oh, this is tense, or this is, really claustrophobic because everything's sort of like happening all at once in this small contained area. And I think that's kind of how I approach it.
Listener Ian asks, what part of writing do you most enjoy?
Oh, enjoying writing. That sounds nice. No,
being done.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the old canard, right? About like, I don't enjoy writing, but I enjoy having written, which I think is true. I like when something unexpectedly delights me that I didn't intend. Sometimes when you're writing, something happens in a story that is kind of out of left field, or you see it coming and you're like, oh, the only logical thing to happen is this thing that I didn't think would happen, but now it's happening. And I enjoy that. I enjoy the curveballs. It's hard at times to have something pop up that you're like, oh, I didn't plan for this, and this might change the entire direction of the story. But it also feels very much like that's how you know you've nailed a target sometimes, is when something steps to the forefront and kind of takes over and you're like, oh, yeah, this is an interesting wrinkle. Now, how am I going to react to that? How am I going to deal with that now that, all my well-laid plans have been laid to waste? So I think that for me is like being surprised and delighted. Sometimes it's a line. Like sometimes I get a line stuck in my head that I just think is funny. And it makes me laugh as I'm writing it. And I laugh when I think about it. And that is, to me, the best moment is like, yeah, okay, it's easy to laugh at your own jokes. But it actually happens fairly rarely, I think, when it comes to writing, especially in like a novel, because there's not always a time for like jokey jokeness. Like you're not doing a tight 10 there or anything.
Yeah, it's a the idea that when you're writing, you're trying to create this simulated reality, right? And so you're building a simulation mm-hmm. of what's happening in your story in your head, and your characters are in it, and the plot is in it. And you're, at least when I have done it, it's you're applying like your logical brain to these details, and it's not abstract. It's like, you've got to say like, where do they go? Where do they stand? Who do they talk to? What do they do? You can't just sort of like say, and they lived happily ever after, right? You have to say how they got to happily ever after
work.
Yeah. You know, he went in the door, and like you have to run the machinery. And the good thing about that is when something unexpected pops out, it's your logical brain saying, no, this is what would happen now. And so it's,
right.
I would say, almost always the right choice, yes. Which is why...
Especially if it's hard.
Yeah, we talk about pantsing and plotting when we talk about this, the idea that you're going by the seat of your pants or you've heavily plotted it out. And while I'm a believer in plotting kind of big picture things, if you overplot, you get that moment where you think, oh, this is what should happen now. Even though I didn't plan it, and you say no, it is the children who are wrong.
There's no surprise.
And that's a mistake, yeah. Right? Because that's your brain saying what's in the outline isn't what would happen next. It doesn't make sense. And it is, when that does happen, I remember Joe Straczynski talked about this for Babylon 5, that he like literally had a point when he was writing all those many, many, many episodes of Babylon 5 where the characters would basically tell him what to do. And it mm-hmm. seemed like wacky, but it's like, well, no, it's he's running the simulation of his show in his head, and the characters are so fully realized in his head that he knows how they would respond, even if it surprises him in the moment,
right?
Like, yeah, that's magical.
That's even more complex on something like a TV show, because then you've got actors involved, right. And actors will make changes, they have interpretations they bring to it as well,
choices.
And that feeds back into the writer, and like that's a cool experience. I've never gotten to write for TV or anything like that, but I do think that aspect of it is very challenging and also very cool.
Tim asks, how do you know when your books are done? How do you go about making the decision to stop tweaking and changing and just put it out there?
Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
Good morning. How do you know when it's done? Well, when the deadline hits, I think that's the first clue. In terms of the plot, I mean, yeah, let's take it first. In terms of like setting down the plot stuff, like that's fairly straightforward, right? Like you get to an end in the story. That's very logical. But in terms of going back and tweaking, I think there is, you know, some of it comes from long experience. You spend a lot of time writing things, and especially I cut my teeth in writing in quick turnaround stuff, right? Because I was working for Jason at Macworld, and I started writing like blog posts, and like blog posts were like, you write a thing, you maybe give it a once over, make sure everything looks good, and then bam, you're done. You move on to the next thing. And so you didn't have the luxury of time all the time to like sort of run down all the details and endlessly tweak stuff. Some of it is just getting tired of the material and you're like, I've read this three times. I'm done. And I think some of it is just, you know, when you're dealing with a book that's like 100,000 words ish, it is time consuming, right? Like it is time consuming to spend all this time tweaking stuff. I think for me, I am done generally when I feel like I have resolved. I usually have a list of, this is sort of my software programmer background coming to play a little bit, but like I have a list of bugs in a story, like when beta readers or my agent or somebody will read it and be like, this doesn't work, right? Like I go down the list and like some of them I agree with, some of them I don't agree with, but I like try to get anything that feels like, hey, this really took somebody out of the story, or this really didn't make sense, and I try to resolve all of those. And once I've resolved all of those, I'm good. I feel like, all right, we've worked out the major kinks in this story. Here's the secret. There's going to be other things, because then it goes through an editorial process. Then it goes through a copy editing process. Then it goes through a proofreading process. And of all of those cases, you will end up changing things. You'll end up tweaking words here and there. You'll end up tweaking sentences. I've even had copy editors who, you know, sometimes maybe exceeding the bounds of their duties have pointed out plot holes. Sometimes those are valid. Sometimes they're not. But, you know, it's at that point, it's done basically when, you know, it's got to get sent off to the printer. I'm not a person who generally spends a lot of time asking for extensions or tries to overshoot a deadline very much. So, yeah, when it needs to be done, it's done.
Do you have a moment where you're thinking, I'm getting close to wrapping it up and I need to button this thing up now? Or do you, I just wonder if you're looking at the word count and thinking, I need to speed this along, or if you're willing to go where it takes you, knowing the destination. And I mean, maybe does that change based on what your deadline is?
I think it changes depending on the story. I mean, like, we've all been in movies where you look at your watch and you're like, there's 45 minutes left in this movie. Like, what's going on? I think I know what the length now of a book in this series is, roughly. Like, there is some variation, but it tends to be plus or minus like 100,000 words. And so that does give me a sense of where am I in this plot and how much farther. I'm always worried that I will underwrite and I will write something. I'll be like, oh no, I finished the story and it's 75,000 words. Like, what am I going to do? I need another 25,000 words. That has yet to happen. But I feel like there is sort of an internal pacing clock too, that you have, at least that I have in my head when I'm writing one of these stories. It's like, I kind of know how the pace should proceed, like the pace of the scenes and the pace of the chapters. Like, it's got a feeling to it. I will say I'm working on something now that is the longest thing I have ever written, and it keeps getting longer. And I'm a little worried, but at the same time, like, I feel the pace in it, and I'm like, oh, I can't just like snap my fingers and end it here. Like, it's not ready. It hasn't gone through all the motions. And it may be that when I go back and reread this and edit it, it gets trimmed down and stuff gets thrown out and whatever. But right now, where I am in telling that story, it's like, well, I could wrap this up in a chapter, but it would be extremely unsatisfying and very, very weird. So you kind of have to trust your internal clock a little bit to tell you like how far along you are.
Do you, just as a follow-up to that, do you think about... Do you just sort of let it happen and worry about the marketing later? Because the first novel I wrote was 150,000 words. And it was sort of a YA story. And the feedback I got from a bunch of people is basically, well, this should be three novels.
Yeah. YA novels are shorter too.
Exactly. I mean, a 50,000 word novel is a very short novel, but if it's a YA novel, that's probably not a bad length. And so it's like, this is two or three books. And you know, I totally was living in the moment of like, I'm just telling the story I'm telling, and I haven't gotten to the end yet. And then I got to the end, and I was like, this is 150,000, 160,000 words. It's way too long.
That's long. Yeah.
Even if it's a good story and it's got bits, but it's huge. And so, do you have that in the back of your mind of like, is this an appropriate length? Or are you more like, look, let me just get it out and I'll worry about it later?
I often have it in the back of my mind. I wrote another book, which is still floating around out there and hasn't been sold yet, but it is a much tighter, I want to say it's like 80,000 words, which is much tighter and much shorter, but it's a different genre. And I think there is an aspect of like, if you Google out there, you'll see like people who all have like, oh, this is this genre. You want a word length between X and Y, you know? And that's not strictly true, but it's generally true, right? Like, most stuff falls in between that. And there are certainly genres where you can get away. If you wrote a 150,000 word, like thriller, I think a lot of people would be like, that's pretty long for a thriller.
Right.
But if you wrote a 150,000 word fantasy novel, some people would be like, well, that's like a medium sized fantasy novel, right? Like, you know, those vary much more. So sure. I think there are word counts that sell better in different genres. And I tend to have that in mind when I'm thinking about the scope of a story, but it's not something I sort of glue myself to.
All right. Listener Flo wants to know, how often did you or do you still have to overcome a point in writing where you think, this will never work out, it's all crap, what the hell am I doing? Is writing a never-ending roller coaster of extreme emotions, or is it more boring than we non-writers imagine? How do you even start a book or a series? I mean, there's a lot of questions here, but let's start with the never-ending roller coaster of extreme emotions versus boredom. And my response, I'm going to just guess here, it's both.
both. Yeah, yep. It's 100% both. I just mentioned I'm working on a project now, and I am utterly convinced this is terrible. Nobody else has read it yet. I've given some of it to my wife, but she hasn't gotten a chance to read it yet. And I think I can look at it, and I definitely, there are times where I despair. I thought the Nova incident when I was writing, I was like, oh God, this is terrible. This is never going to work. And my wife read it and she's like, I think this is your best book yet. And I was like, really? I still don't believe you, but thank you. And I think there is a lot of element. You see all the flaws, right? I was thinking about this recently in regards to when we moved into our house, we had our kitchen done. And now, you know, 9 months later, whatever, we look around and every once in a while you're like, oh man, that just isn't, that's a little crooked, right? Or like there's a slight nick in that. And you think to yourself, oh God, it's so terrible. That's just going to bug me every time I'm thinking about how that doesn't line up correctly. And if you ask somebody who came into your kitchen, they'd be like, what are you talking about? Right? Oh, this looks great. But it's yours. You've lived with it. You were instrumental in all the decisions that led to it. You know, it's going to stand out way worse to you than it is somebody else who is coming in and looking at it for the first time. So I think you're always harder on yourself. And as such, it becomes a bit of a roller coaster. Because it's also like this intellectual pursuit in some ways that's so tied up with your creativity and your imagination and your identity that, like, I think people take it very, it's a very personal thing. And so it is always going to have that roller coaster. That said, the day by day is often very boring because it's like, I literally am just putting one word after another, knowing I've got to get to this place. It's like, I don't run very much, but like, I can imagine, you know, if you're a long distance runner, you just kind of get into that like zone out move. It's like, all right, this doesn't feel great, but I'm going to do it. And I know I'm going to get somewhere.
Best times when I'm running is when I'm completely lost in the podcast I'm listening to and I don't even notice. And the worst times when I'm running is like when I'm literally aware of every step that I'm taking.
Yes.
Yep. And so you want to have that moment. But as a writer, let me tell you, as a reader, you can fly through stuff and you just are part of it. Writing it though, you can't, it is frustrating and boring. Remind me, so I always wrote my stuff when I was writing NaNoWriMo novels linearly, where I would I would go in order. I know I've talked to somebody, was it you or was it someone else, who was like, oh no, I write all the interesting parts first. And I thought, how can you do that? Because you're left with half a book that it's all the boring parts, and you have to sit there for weeks on end writing the boring parts of the book. You can't do it. You got to keep the exciting parts. It's like the candy. It's your dessert. It's your thing that you do after the boring part.
Was that a Helene thing, maybe? Because she has that
maybe
very, very wild way of writing.
Maybe it was. Maybe it was Helene.
Every time I think
it's
about
like,
it, I'm like, no!
I can't, not that it wouldn't be great to write all the good parts, but it's like, then I think of like, but then the bad parts. Because the bad parts are bad. Like, if you've got like, oh, there's a really exciting thing coming up. Once I get through this boring chapter, I get to kick the, you know, I press the button and the thing comes out and then it's super exciting, but I got to get there first. And it's like a motivator to get there.
I can't imagine
saving the boring parts, because when it's boring, and it's not like the book is, it's not like reading that part is boring. It's that
exactly.
It's the necessary kind of rising building action and getting all the pieces in place and all the details. But writing that stuff can be a super grind, and I cannot imagine not interspersing that with the fun stuff and leaving it till the end. Wow.
Yeah, I go almost exclusively front to back. I've occasionally had things where I write out of order, but very rarely, because I think it helps me keep it all in my head of this thing happened, now the next thing needs to happen, now the next thing needs to happen. If I start jumping around too much, I'm like, oh man, where am I? What has happened?
Right.
What still is going to happen?
Yeah, it's messy.
And I screw stuff up and then I have to go back and fix it later. So, I mean, sometimes I do that anyways, but it's a lot easier if I'm writing front to back. So, and as far as the boring parts go, yeah, it's a slog sometimes to get through them. You try to make them interesting and you try to think about like, well, what is really important in this scene? But yeah, it's more fun to write a car chase sometimes than it is to write two people looking at something. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. That leads to a car chase, but
yes, exactly.
Flo's other question. How do you even start a book or a series? Is it just a bunch of ideas or scenes that you try to connect, or do you have a story arc in mind that you flesh out? Do the characters determine what kind of story you write, or is it the other way around? Did you have Kovalik in mind because he acts like he does and the story had to evolve in a certain way, or did the story you wanted to tell lead to the creation of that character?
That's interesting. I think it's all kind of works together. I mean, how do you start? You start with, I mean, You can start a variety of ways. You can just start putting words down on paper. That's how I started doing my earliest stuff. I would say I didn't finish a lot of that when I was much younger, but like that's where it would start. I think for me, it starts a lot of times with a scene or dialogue. Like I'll come up with like a exchange between two characters and be like, oh, that's interesting. Why are they talking about this? Who are these people? Like, why, what is this conversation leading to? And then that starts to spin out. Like, you know, it's a bit of a chain reaction thing. Like as soon as you start thinking about those things, you start thinking about other things. And then like ideas sort of bounce off each other. And you're like, oh, well, hold on. I had this other idea that was about this. I wonder if that connects to this in some way. It's a lot like doing a puzzle. And so for me, characters often come first before plots because I have an idea of like, all right, who is this person? Oh, I want to write a character who's, you know, this way and that way. And then you're like, well, what would be an interesting situation? Or where would this person likely find themselves? So I don't think, and there's evolution to it too, right? Because I don't think Kovalik came into my mind fully formed. I knew who he was and what his role was, like what his job was. But I don't think I necessarily knew his personality entirely until I was writing these books. And even then, like it changes from book to book, like not wildly, right? Because people are roughly the same, but like, stuff happens and then that affects you as a person. And so that builds on top of each other till you have a more complex person. And sure, there's still some character traits that shine through there, but you know, ultimately a person is the sum of all their experiences. So that is kind of how it comes to play.
Okay. Picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Listener Josh wants to know, when writing, did you ever feel the need to alter something because of a piece of media that came out that had a plot device or character or anything else that was too similar?
Yeah, probably. I'm trying to think of a concrete example. I definitely have written books and then, or like come up with ideas for stories and then seen somebody do a very similar story and be like,
yeah,
well now I can't do that. Or yeah. I need to come up with something that's going to set it so far apart that people will not confuse the two or not think, oh, this came up for this. I'm trying to remember, like there was something recently where I felt like, this is a fine line to walk because there's a lot of stuff where like, you know, stuff you write gets inspired by other stuff.
Sure.
That you read or watch or whatever. And you're like, oh, man, I loved that scene in this movie where this happened. I wonder if I can like do something similar, like to convey a similar idea or have a similar scene. And, you know, sometimes that does bleed over. But, you know, if you've done it well, your characters are different and the plot's different and stuff. So it may be a similar scene, but it's like the context is different. I'm trying to think if I've explicitly changed. I think I've changed names where it's like, oh, that name is too connected to something else now. And now I just want to not dredge up sort of connections with that.
My first novel, I had a character who was a cheerleader and then Heroes came out.
Yeah.
And I was like, damn it. And so she became a volleyball player because...
There you go. Yeah.
I had to be different. It couldn't be.
There are little tweaks like that you can make where sometimes something just doesn't quite work and you're like, oh, I gotta
it's just like
this.
It resonates too much. It's like, didn't Heroes do that? And it's like, yeah, okay, fine.
It's frustrating too.
Nobody remembers it now. I could put it back, but it's
right.
Too,
exactly.
It's too late.
It's a callback. It's an homage.
A decade
now.
Ago. Yeah.
It's a finely aged wine.
Yeah. But I think you're right. You do have those like the thing that you've got in your list and you're like, oh, somebody did that. I'll put that on the, you know, put it on the shelf until I can come up with a different take on it.
The worst is when you've already written it and then somebody else is like, oh, this is just like that scene in blah. And you're like,
oh no,
yeah. Damn it.
that's not good. Different Dan, listener Dan says,
hi, listener Dan.
Or maybe you ask yourself this question. I don't know. What software do you use in crafting your books?
Crafting.
Bookcraft. It's like Minecraft.
I've got a little chisel and a hammer. Mm-hmm. I use Scrivener, which is my workhorse for this. It is great. I don't use a huge percentage of the features it has.
Nope.
Our pal Anthony Johnson uses it and uses it totally differently from me.
Isn't that great?
I love it. Scrivener is a great tool because it really can be anything to anyone. And there are a lot of people who's like, oh, it's so complex. And it's like, yeah, it's true. It is definitely more complex than sitting down and opening like a Word document. but it's also very powerful and it kind of conforms to what you want to do. So like I have seen, for example, in Scrivener, you can have documents, and a lot of people I know that's sort of designed to be like, it's a scene and then your scenes go into a folder, which is your chapter. And it's like, I don't think in scenes, I think in chapters. So for me, every document is a chapter.
Right.
And that just works for me. And it's got a lot of other tools that you can use for like storing research and stuff. I tend to just create like blank documents in like the separate section that aren't part of the manuscript where I just write stuff down, but I don't use a lot of like the templates and stuff in there. It's more work than I need to do. I've occasionally used other tools, Scapple, I want to say, which is also by, I think it's the same company.
Yeah. Literature. Yeah.
Which is like, yeah. Which is like kind of a mind mapping, you know, brainstorming thing. So I've used that a little bit to just draw out ideas or stuff like that. Other than that, like I use notes. Like that is my other place where I keep just ideas that I have is like, oh, I open up a notes file and I have, you know, a folder that's all writing stuff. And then I have different folders for different projects. And I will just sort of jot down ideas in there because it's everywhere, right? It's on my phone. I can write something down, or I can write something down on my iPad or my Mac, and it's everywhere and I can always find it. And that's all I really need. Like I try to keep my tools fairly simple and not get bogged down, because I think that is a trap, which is people get so invested in like, what tools do I need to be a real writer? And it's like, no, you just need a thing where you can put words. It's literally it. I know Pete Brett, who is a fantasy writer and a fellow agency mate of mine, has written this huge fantasy book, and he started writing it on his phone, I think. Like, and this was before like smartphone era, maybe early sort of smartphone era, but he wrote like 160,000 word book that like was mostly on his phone because he would do it on his commutes on the subway. And it's like, that works, do it, right? You know, if you write, or you need to write on paper or whatever, do that. I mean, it's whatever you use that can get the words out of you.
That's a good point, which is in the end, the tools don't matter.
No, it's a distraction.
It is. Yeah. In fact, if you obsess over the tools, distracting yourself from writing.
Yeah.
Kate wants to know, have you had to change your writing process due to the pandemic? And if so, how did that impact you?
I did. So we talked about Nova Incident was written during 2020. I want to say I started in like maybe August 2020 or so. So a few months into the pandemic. And prior to this, as listeners probably of previous episodes where we discussed my writing, I was a regular. I would get up in the morning. I would go down to the coffee shop. I would do some writing there. I would have my cup of tea or two, and then I'd come back and have lunch and work in my day job stuff. Couldn't go to the coffee shop anymore. So that was an interesting change. I think the last time I sort of went to the coffee shop was like right in March, right as things were starting to shut down. And so as a result, I wrote pretty much this entire story in my home, which is weird. I didn't, because I'd never written any other book entirely in where I lived. I would go to coffee shops, or I would write them while I was traveling or stuff like that. But I very rarely worked on a novel while I was at home, because for me, that was sort of like that's like my work environment, quote unquote, like where I'm doing other stuff, podcasting or writing tech stuff or whatever. And so a lot of that I wrote sitting in my Poang IKEA chair in my living room in my old apartment. And that was, it felt different. And I think that's part of what informed the feeling of the novel being more claustrophobic, was the fact that I was stuck someplace. And so I was like, well, I'm going to sort of, I can sort of draw on that for this story that is a little more self-contained to a planet, instead of having these like, jumping between all these different worlds and feel like there's some tension from the fact that you can't escape this place. That was a big change for me. And now it's now become routine for me. Like I still don't go to the coffee shop. I have been a couple times in the past 2 years, but I usually get up and go get my cup of tea and then sit in our dining room where we have some nice armchairs, and that's where I write now.
Yeah, a real value in changing your context when you're writing. I mean, just in general, not just for novels, but like I find it incredibly valuable to get up from my desk, because I don't sit at my desk and write all day, right? I'm managing stuff, and I'm doing podcasts and stuff like that. And then when it comes time, you and I both write weekly columns for Macworld, I will almost always write that column somewhere that is not my desk. It's usually in the summer months, it's outside under my redwood tree in a camp chair.
And in the cooler times, it's usually at the bar in my kitchen. But going to a different location makes a difference.
Right. And I often write my macro column at my desk because it's like the one thing I do write at my desk. And not always, but a lot of times it's like, oh, well, this is work. I'm going to go to the workplace.
Go to the work. That makes sense in a strange way. Human brains, we're wacky.
Weird.
Mark wants to know, do you have any specific writing goals or routines when you're working on a novel? And does that change for different parts of the writing and revision process?
Well, it changes by the novel, I'll tell you that much. Like, I mentioned again this project I've been working on. I've been kind of working on it pretty solidly since the beginning of the year. And I set myself a goal of doing 1,000 words on every weekday. And I can do more than that if I want, and I can write on other days if I want. But my restriction was every day of the week, Monday through Friday, I'm doing 1,000 words. And my rationale was like, 1,000 words is very often doable. Because it's not like a huge amount. I feel confident in my ability to do it. And doing it on the weekdays lets me sort of have off days, kind of like when you're, you know, exercising, right? You have rest days, like you need to let your body recover. And I have found that that is extremely doable. With very few exceptions, I have not missed. I think when we went on vacation, I was traveling, I maybe wrote one day and then the rest of the days were like, not really. But every other day, basically since the beginning of this year, I basically put 1,000 words down. And
good job.
Yeah, I it worked. I don't know why. Like, I've tried this in the past with like, oh, you know, NaNoWriMo, right? Like, you think, oh, 50,000 words, 30 days.
Yeah, it's 1,667. Yep.
Yeah. And you're like, great, as long as I do that. And it's like some days 1,600 words is pretty hard.
Yeah. And, yeah, well, it's an average over 30 days, though, right?
Like, so some days you do more and some days you do less. But like every day you do less, you always have that in your back of your head. Like, oh, no, I need to
make
that up.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's when you get to the fun part.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Not the boring part.
stuff gets wild then. So I try to do that as a routine. Editing is a little more free form for me because it's harder to gauge. Like, you know, I'll break stuff down by chapters and do like, oh, I'm going to do 5 chapters today or whatever. I'm going to do occasionally like 10,000 words or something like that. I think it's just a faster process, though. It depends on what. Sometimes you just get really bogged down. You're like, oh, this thing really isn't working. It's not like, oh, I got to change this word or this sentence had a grammar error. It's like, this is broken and I need to fix this. And you might bang your head against it for an hour or several days even, depending on how complex a problem it is. So I don't tend to set myself as much goals. That's more of a time thing. It's like, all right, I got, you know, 2 hours to do some editing before I do other stuff.
Do you do, when you're writing, do you do the NaNoWriMo thing and try to just plow ahead and figure out that this is a thing you'll fix later? Or do you get tempted by the, I'm going to go back and tweak this? And because NaNoWriMo, the whole idea is you just keep putting the words down and you'll deal with it in draft because the point is to move forward.
Fix it in post.
Yeah.
I try to do that. I try not to get too bogged down. Sometimes I get stuck because I have to go back and refer to something and I'm like, oh, what was that name or what did I call that? And I'll have to like search through my Scriven document and be like, oh, is that? And oh, wait a second. Now that I'm back there. I just had that today, actually. I was like searching for a term I'd used in this book. And I saw another term listed next to it. I'm like, what was that? What did I mean by that? I don't think I've referred to that anywhere else. And then I was like, I just got to leave it there. I leave it there and I keep moving. So I try to just plow ahead because I find it's a different side of your brain, right? Yeah. You wouldn't start editing a podcast when you're in the middle of recording it.
I don't recommend it.
I think that would cause a lot of problems.
Yeah.
So I try to just keep going.
All right. Let us do our audio question now.
Oh, audio question.
We have one audio question from Listener James. Does Listener James introduce himself? We'll see.
Hi, Listener James here. Dan, I'm wondering, what has been the coolest perk of being a published author that was a surprise to you?
What has been the coolest perk of being a published author that's been surprised to you? I think in some ways, I mean, meeting people who have read my book. Actually, I will say my favorite stories are, and this has happened twice that people have reported it, is people who have been, I made shirts for my books that have like the Commonwealth logo and the Illyrican Empire logo. And twice people have reported to me being somewhere and somebody recognizing the shirt. And I was like, I don't know if that's a perk, but it was like a moment where I was like, oh, there are just strangers who have read my book meeting other strangers who have read my book. That's weird.
Isn't that wild?
I think that's great. And you know, as such, running into any fans, like whether it's at like an author event that I do or when we're out like doing the Apple WWDC or something and running into people who have read the book and say nice things, like, is that a perk? I don't know. I consider that a perk.
Yeah.
I love it. It's just delightful to have that like be a real world thing instead of the faceless masses out there.
I was going to say being on panels at like conventions and stuff is
that's fun.
You know, when it's you're a published author, so you are now enshrined in that. In that ability, you're legitimate for that now.
Yeah, I've done panels a few times at Worldcon, and I did one this year at the Nebula conference, which was a first for me, and that's fun. It is super fun to be able to do that. I think actually this is what I will say is my favorite perk is actually being able to just meet other authors that I really admire and like have conversations with them, like, you know, just chat or like I find that kind of cool. Like, I don't know. I've met a few different people, but like recently, not that long ago, this year, I was at a party after a book event that was held locally. And I went to this party at a writer's house afterwards, and I was like talking to Scott Lynch, who is like a writer that I really love and admire.
Oh, yeah, wow.
And like, that was really cool. I was just like, oh, let's just, you know, shoot the breeze with Scott Lynch.
Hey, Eliza Locke Lamora, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I love that book. And he's just a guy, like, you know, just having
just
a normal conversation. It wasn't like a deep conversation about writing or anything,
no.
But like, I don't know, it was kind of cool to talk to people whose work you really admire.
Yeah, I met Anne Leckie at Worldcon and I was like, I like your books. It was just, I didn't even know what to say. It's like, you know.
It's tough.
Yeah.
But.
So we had the audio question. Here's the audiobook questions. Matthew wants to know, is the audiobook coming out on a different schedule than the book release?
For this particular book, I don't know. Last information I was told was
coming out on July 26th? The answer is yes.
Yeah, I mean, well, you'll know by the time probably you hear this podcast whether or not what the schedule actually is. Because I'm sure by the time that the book is ready to come out, I'll at least know whether the audiobook is coming out at the same time or what a date will be.
Oh, interesting.
I think I can say... I don't think this is giving. Who cares? Well,
this is the. This,
I can't
this
say.
Is,
I,
yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
I literally got an email yesterday, as we record this, from the narrator, who is the same narrator who did the last two books, and he was asking me about like if there were any new pronunciation stuff, and I was like, "Oh, I didn't know. Like, I knew we were trying to maintain that continuity. I didn't know that we had actually gotten him back. So I was glad to hear that. So the continuity, the Victor Bevin. I mean, he's saying his name wrong. Bevine, who did the narration on the Bayern Agenda and Aleph Extraction, will be doing the Nova Incident book.
Nice. So there is an audiobook. It's
there
just
is
a,
one. There is one.
It's
I
just matter,
don't know.
Is it coming it's, out?
There's
right
a
away
there's
or,
a boring business reason yeah. here, which is that it's a different company doing it, and I don't know what their schedule is.
Right. So this is leads us into Jonathan's question, which is, how are the audiobook versions of your books handled? I notice you have two different companies making the audio versions of your books so far.
Yeah, so this is a business question, and the answer is essentially what happens is there are different sets of rights for the print, ebook, and audio, and usually it kind of varies. Some publishers will be like, "Hey, when you sign the contract, we would like the audio rights. We will sell them, and we will cut you in for some of the money." Also, if you can manage to keep those rights to yourself, which if you have an agent, and you should absolutely have an agent if you're ever dealing with this, because they are invaluable when it comes to dealing with rights, a good agent will be like, "Hey, we want to try to keep the audio rights." This is a lot harder with big publishers because they have a lot more leverage. But if you're at a sort of a smaller press, then you can often try to keep the audio rights and then sell them yourself, which means you get more money because you are not splitting it with the publisher of your print and ebooks, which when you think about it, makes sense. Why should they get cut in on the audio rights? So the answer is when we did the Caledonian Gambit, my publisher was Talos. And they took the audio rights and they sold them to a company called Tantor, which is a fairly large audiobook production company. And when I did Bayern and Aleph, we kept the audio rights and we sold those to Audible. So Audible produced those. And then when we did Nova, we offered it to Audible. They did not want them. And so we sold it to Tantor again. Ah. So I'm back with the publisher for the first time around. So... all good people. I'm very happy with all the audiobook work that has been done across all these companies. you know, I think I am not an audiobook person, but mostly I've heard good things from people who have listened to the audiobook versions.
That leads us to Saskia's question, which is, have you ever listened to the audiobook versions of your own books, and do the readers or producers ever approach you for pronunciation guidelines?
Yes, they absolutely do approach me, as I just mentioned.
Yes.
In the past, I've also recorded every once in a while. Like, I've done like a, I was like, oh, I have a microphone. I can just record a thing that tells you how these are all pronounced, if that's helpful. And so I have done pronunciations because I have feelings on how things should be pronounced.
Mm.
I know, for example, my main character, who is Kovalik, that is how I pronounce it. I've heard there are different pronunciations, but that's just how I hear it in my head, and that's how I prefer it be pronounced. Whether you, if you pronounce it something different in your head when you're reading, that's fine.
Right. If you say Kowalich, that's fine.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's just not how I would pronounce it. I don't tend to listen to the audiobooks. I don't know why, but it's very uncomfortable for me to hear somebody else read stuff that I have written. I don't particularly like it. It makes me antsy, and I it's not that they're not doing a good job, it's just it's very cringe feeling for me, like, oh, did I really write that?
Yeah.
Oh man, I should have done better, I should have put that different, because I don't always write stuff expecting it to be heard aloud,
right?
I'm hearing it in my head, or I'm reading stuff in my head, and it feels different when you hear somebody speaking those words, and it's like, I just wish I hadn't done that. So I don't know. It's a very uncomfortable feeling for me. So I certainly don't do it end to end. I've every once in a while like played it just out of curiosity, and it's like I get that it's like a fingernails on a chalkboard thing. It's like, oh no, I can't listen to this, and then I stop.
All right, here's a lightning round. Hello, head casting question from Mihir. Again, just checking in. I think we've played this game before, but checking in now. Who would you cast to play the leading roles in your series?
I always struggle with this question. I don't have a good answer. We've talked about it before.
Yeah.
And Jason has his casting. I have
Mark Valley.
My casting.
Is he still
I like
your
Mark Valley?
Come on.
We were just maybe because I'm just thinking about For All Mankind. I was like, Joel Kinnaman. Yeah, he could kind of do it.
Yeah,
he's too tall, but he's got the right demeanor for it.
Yeah.
I don't have an Eli one though. I never have an Eli one.
No,
I don't know. He's a little closer to me, I think, is the problem.
Yeah.
So I struggle with that.
Yeah, I was going to say, Kovalik is who you want to be, and Eli is who you are.
If you don't deserve me at my Kovalik, you know.
Yeah. Kevin wants to know, very important question, are any of your characters based on your podcast co-hosts?
Only the ones I kill. I don't think, I've occasionally named characters after people I know, but I don't think anybody's based after somebody.
All right.
Not really.
Marcella has a great question, which is better, the Nova Incident or Panic's Nova app?
Well, if you want to basically have an integrated development environment, definitely my book. But if you want to read a really great
page turner,
Panic from Nova, obviously.
Panic's getting into everything these days. It's amazing.
No,
wait till the
Playdate adaptation of my book is coming.
Oh, can you imagine Cold War the game?
What would that be?
I don't know.
Right.
It's just Spy
Hunter
with
rockets.
If you're
a game developer and have an idea, hit me up. Maybe we can make a deal.
All right. Flipper says, what is your favorite espionage TV series, and have you seen Callan, the British 70s spy series?
No, I don't know that.
Somebody
one.
get Stephen Shapansky on the horn. He's probably either going to watch that or has watched that or is watching it right now. Our friend who loves 70s TV, British 70s
TV. Well, so, and along those lines, my favorite spy TV show is The Sandbaggers, which is also a Stephen Shapansky favorite. I would actually add, though, close second to that, I think in recent years, Counterpart is a great spy series, really, and it does the spy sci-fi thing from a totally different angle.
Totally different, yeah.
And I love it. It's so good. And then I have a fond spot for a show called Covert Affairs, which ran on USA, which is kind of just a fun, a little bit by the numbers, but it is at points really well executed. So I rewatched that during the pandemic, and it actually inspired some of the ideas in the Nova Incident. So I will throw that out there as an homage.
I really liked Slow Horses.
Slow Horses is also great. Also good. Yep.
Timothy says, have you ever been tempted to introduce technology that is more magical than scientific? For example, teleportation. Where do you draw the line in terms of your invented sci-fi world?
That's a good question. The Galactic Cold War world is fairly well rooted in our world, with the exception of things like there's wormhole travel between different space systems. A lot of the critiques of my book are that they're not science fiction enough, whatever that means. But I think they mean like this technology feels too close to our world.
Right.
But that's in some parts because I think that's just the way in my brain this world evolved. It was a, you know, sort of a different stuff got reset a bit in terms of how things got spread out. I think what's interesting to me is the constraints of technology, and having magical technology, if it enables your story, is great, but I wanted to do things where the technology often held people back. So the fact that there are wormholes connecting different places in the galaxy, unlike, say, just having a ship with an FTL drive that can go wherever, whenever it wants, is an interesting, I mean, that's kind of the fundamental conflict in the Caledonian Gambit, right?
Right.
It's like, what if you had this, and then what if something broke it, you know? And I think that is an interesting constraint to me. And then it also enables other constraints because I've had to think about things like, well, if everything else is limited, like you don't have fast stuff that's faster than light, how do you do communications between different star systems?
Right.
It's like, that's actually a hard problem to solve, as we see in like
Ansibles
science.
Or bottles, messages.
Yeah, in mine,
bottles,
it ends up being essentially like we send little drones through the wormholes and then they shoot out radio signals, but like, take some time, right?
Yeah.
It's a little bit more like writing a letter than it is like having instantaneous communication.
What's up with that faster than light ship from the Caledonian Gambit, by the way? I haven't heard a lot about that.
Yeah. Well,
you'd think that would have an impact on the Galactic Cold War.
You think that might be something important for later?
All right. I don't know. I haven't read your next book, Dan.
I haven't written it, Jason.
That's okay. That's fair. Fair. I also don't know what's in it, but it strikes me every now and then. It's like, oh yeah, that was kind of a game changer.
I seeded a lot of stuff out there that I'm hoping I could tie up into a nice little bow at some point when I eventually get around to finishing this.
So everybody please buy the Nova Incident July 26th.
Buy the Nova Incident. Yeah, there you go.
You should do that. Related, Ben wants to know, given the near infinite ways to handle faster than light in space empire fiction, how did you pick yours?
I mean, if you read the Caledonian Gambit, it came because I wanted the plot of that. The imagery of it, in my world, there are wormholes, there are gates that essentially are science fictional creations that have been designed to keep wormholes stable and open so that people can pass through them. Mm-hmm. I actually have in my head a prequel story that sort of deals with humanity's first experience with that, which I don't know, maybe I'll write someday. But I wanted to do a story in which, you know, the events, this is not too much of a spoiler because it's literally the prologue of the Caledonian Gambit. A wormhole gate is destroyed and that causes severe havoc and problems. And so I liked that idea of not having the freedom to go anywhere. It's like, oh, well, like it's like a bridge washed out. It's like, just can't get there. Right. You got to go the long way around. And I think that's an interesting idea. I have different ideas for other, you know, if I'm working on other sci-fi stuff, I was like, I would probably be more tempted to use things that are a little more standard FTL stuff because like, you know, that's not the problem you're trying to address in every book. But in this universe, it was the interesting element to me.
Carrie wants to know what your favorite sci-fi book is.
Well, I'm going to have to pick a Lois McMaster Bujold book. It's Memory, which is my favorite of her books because it is both a great sci-fi story. It's a great spy thriller. It's a great sci-fi story. And it's a great bit of character development. Mm. It is about Miles Vorkosigan, the hero of that story, turning 30 and essentially having like not quite a midlife crisis, but a little bit of midlife crisis as he realizes he can't keep doing this job that he was doing. And then he has to sort of unfold a plot that's happening simultaneously. So that book is wonderful. I think it won the Hugo. It at least was nominated, I think, or maybe the Nebula. I don't know. But it's one of her best. And she wrote a lot of good books.
Thomas wants to know, do you have an ending planned for the Galactic Cold War?
Yeah, I don't know how much to go into about, like, yes, I will say absolutely I have an ending planned. I kind of know what the last big scene is. I'm struggling a little bit right now, so I will say, just for the purposes of transparency, because we've addressed it several times already, I don't have a contract for any more books in this series right now. So as of this very moment when you are listening to this, there are no books being written and there are no books on the schedule. If you would like that to change, you know what you have to do.
July 26th, the Nova Incident.
Buy this book, buy the last books, have your friends buy them, et cetera, et cetera. I think one way or another, I will wrap it up because the idea of having a story that doesn't conclude and knowing what that ending is bothers me.
Right.
I get frustrated when I read a book or watch a TV series, right? That's a great example. Like a TV series, you're like, oh, this is cool. They're building this plot that happens over several seasons and it gets canceled and they never get to finish it. It's worse with TV shows because like there's a big production budget and all that, right? It's really hard. You got to get the actors back, etc. I think of the show Carnival, which was this very detailed HBO show. And it had this really elaborate plot and they had this plan for like six seasons, I think it was, and it got canceled after two. And so a lot of stuff went unanswered. And then years later, the show Bible for it was leaked. It was like you could find it on the internet and you read it and you're like, oh, man, like now I know what happens. But it's so much more boring when it's laid out just like.
Yeah.
And then this happens, and then this happens. That's because of this. It's like, no, the whole point was that it was like mystery unfolding over time. And it's like, I don't want to just somebody tell me what was going on. I wanted to experience that. So,
well, your challenge is going to be, because obviously you could publish it yourself as an ebook,
which I may do.
And you're just going to have to calculate the amount of work that's going to go into writing it and producing it, and the trade-off with how many sales you think you're going to get. Even though if you're selling it yourself, you've got a probably better deal.
And I kind of ran an experiment with that earlier this year. I put out some, I've been doing short stories set in the Galactic Cold War universe. And I did my first original one that was not sort of a repurposed deleted scene from one of the earlier books. And I charged $1.99 for it. And I was like, I just want to see how this goes. And the answer was, it's okay, but it didn't necessarily recoup even the amount of time it spent to produce and,
right,
make that. So that makes me think, well, a novel's different. It's a little more, not only more time investment for me, but I think more people are willing to pony up some money for a novel. So it's something I'm strongly considering doing if I can't find a way to sort of conclude this otherwise. I would obviously love to continue on with my publisher, but again, it all depends on sales.
Right.
That's just the kind of mercenary world we live in, unfortunately.
That's just how it is. James says, you've spoken about the influence of Vor Kosigan. One of my favorite things about the series is the wild shifts in genre and tone from spy thriller to comedy of manners, for example. If given the opportunity, what other genre would be the most fun to drop Simon and the gang into? I had a good laugh imagining them being forced to work security for their galaxy's version of the Oscars.
That would be funny. I mean, I think I would do a comedy. I try to inject a lot of humor in the books as it is, and so I think some of the most fun moments are when people are confronted with a situation that is like totally outside of their area of expertise. So sort of a fish out of water comedy scene would, I think, be super fun. I mean, it's already a science fiction thing and sort of a spy thriller. I don't know how many other genres I can like sort of jump onto that. Like I'm tempted to do like a straight up mystery, but I think that's, it's weird to write a straight up mystery in sci-fi. Although I guess Asimov kind of did it with those, with the
robots,
the robot books. So yeah, I think either a comedy or a mystery. I know those are kind of adjacent. I mean, or just, get wild and drop it in the middle of like, oh, it's Ted Lasso, but with the Galactic Cold War cast.
Interesting.
There you go.
It's what's the most popular sport on this planet?
I think it's grav ball the one that I referenced a bunch.
It's like rollerball, grab ball, all the balls.
Yeah, it's got gravities and balls.
A couple more really quickly. Kate wants to know, if you had two of the characters from your books on Clockwise, who would you choose and what would you discuss?
Tapper and that would just be so much fun. Tapper and probably Natalie Taylor, and the reason is because Nat is extremely smart and she would be interested in discussing technology topics, and she would be really insightful too. And then Tapper would just be hilarious because his answer to everything is like, well, I just blow it up.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, why doesn't
just
this
put
thing
explosives
blow up
on it? Yeah, and that, I think that'd be delightful.
And I have one more question, and I'm going to say, if you're very 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 sensitive to hints and spoilers, you could tune out now. This is the last question, and thank you for listening. But I don't know even if Dan will. Well, let's just see. Neil wrote, this question has a spoiler for the end of Byron Agenda. When you killed off Paige at the end of Byron, had you already conceived of the character of Sayers to replace him on the team, or did you create her in the course of plotting Aleph? So
I can answer that question. She was always intended to join the team. Always. I had her in mind from the first book. I just didn't have space to develop her the way I wanted to in the earlier stories. And I had always known what was going to happen to Paige in Bairn. Like, that was part of the plan all along. And so that created this great opportunity to be like, well, they have to find someone to replace him on the team. And I wanted to get someone that was very different from him. He's got a very specific personality. He goes about things in a very specific way. And I wanted to have the team shaken up and challenged by the fact that now they have to deal with somebody who is kind of a polar opposite and like just much more impulsive, much less measured. I thought that contrast would be a lot of fun. But I had always wanted to bring Sarahs on. I had been super excited, you know, even when writing Gambit, because I had plotted out a bunch of this. Like knowing that she was sort of in the wings waiting to come in, but I really needed a room in a novel to have her take the stage as she has in Aleph, and she's also a narrator in the Nova Incident as well. So yeah, I was always really excited about bringing her on, but she was sort of deliberately in some ways conceived to be a different character, a very distinct character from Paige. So that's what I'll say to that.
And I think it's fair to say that in the Nova Incident, the fact that Paige gets killed off at the end of Bairn comes back, right? Like that is not an event without consequences to the story.
Yes. And I, you know, I had to kind of deal with that in Aleph too, because there is some challenges for both Brody and Kovalik in dealing with that, as well as Sarah's having to fill those shoes. And so there is some, you know, I wanted it to be a incident that, like you said, had repercussions and left a lasting impact on the people involved in it, because you don't want to just brush that off. It's significant, right? Like, it's something big that happened. So it was something that was always planned. It was always part of sort of my overall story idea. And I wanted to basically tease out some, you know, some challenges in that department.
All right. Well, Dan, thank you for talking about writing and books, and people should buy the Nova Incident and all the other books in this series, quite frankly. Whether it's 3 or 4, it doesn't really matter. Just buy them so that Dan can keep writing the books in this series. And once again, it's been fun. It's always fun to talk to you about this stuff, and this is a sort of a special thing. And what I always wonder, like, do people want to hear us do this? And then at the end of the year, people always cite these episodes as some of their favorites of the year. So thank you for coming back.
Glad to hear that. Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. I love talking about writing, especially because Jason, I know how much you're invested in as well. Obviously, that's your career and you've written novels and stuff like that. And someday we'll turn the tables and I'll interview you about your novel.
Yeah, man. You know, I wish I... ironically, leaving my regular corporate job and going out on my own is the thing that killed my ability to write novels, because every moment that I'm not doing my independent work job, I feel like I'm shirking. And so it's something that I've really got to try to find a mental structure to get to set aside some time where it's okay for me to do something else. And it just hasn't happened. So strange.
Yeah, there's maybe always someday. Time.
There is always time. All right. Well, thank you to everybody out there for listening to this episode of The Incomparable. We'll be back next week with something completely different, undoubtedly. And once again, thank you to Dan.
Thank you.